You're listening to the AHDB podcast, practical know-how to help your farm business.
Hello, welcome to this AHDB podcast. AHDB has launched their first Carbon Week, running the 1st to the 5th of March, with the aim of sharing factual and practical information about reducing carbon emissions on farms. AHDB say it can be tough to know who and what to listen to, and the more we all understand about the carbon cycle and where levy payers fit into it, the sooner we can all understand how to best make a difference. Farming in the UK is responsible for just 10% of the nation's total greenhouse gas emissions, and through sustainable land use and good management practices, landowners and farmers can have a really positive impact on reducing this still further to benefit the environment. After all, soil has the ability to absorb carbon from the atmosphere and lock it into the ground. I'm John Bates, and I'm told knowing your carbon footprint is key and the place to start. So, in this podcast, as part of the activity of Carbon Week, I'm joined by knowledgeable guests to tell us what we all need to know. This podcast is obviously recorded as we're in working from home mode, and so there is some varying sound quality. Apologies for that. First, we've got John Foote. Thanks for joining us, John, on this podcast. Give us a bit of an overview, if you would, of what you do for the organisation.
Hi, I'm John Foote, and I'm the Head of Environment at AHDB.
So what is greenhouse gas?
That's a really good question. So greenhouse gases are all around us in the atmosphere, and they are very important because they trap heat. Without that, it would be pretty cold here on planet Earth. They let the sunlight pass through the atmosphere, and then when the sunlight hits the ground, it's radiated back as heat, and it prevents that heat that the sunlight brings from leaving the atmosphere. The main greenhouse gases are water vapour, carbon dioxide, and there are a range of other sort of gases in smaller volumes. But they all have a powerful impact, and they all survive in the atmosphere for different times. And the ones that are most of interest to agriculture are methane and nitrous oxide.
So why is everything measured in carbon?
Well, really, this is down to the way that we have to account for everything on a common basis. So we talk about carbon dioxide or CO2 equivalents. And it's a standard measurement for measuring carbon footprints and meeting international obligations. The idea is to sort of express the impact of each of these greenhouse gases in a single term that can be added up and used in a standardised way. So, you know, for example, methane has a global warming potential that's 28 times greater than that of carbon dioxide.
So often agriculture is portrayed as a bit of a demon. What is agriculture's actual contribution?
So agriculture here in the UK amounts to 10% of UK PLC's emissions. So that's, you know, we look at the emissions across all of the sectors. The largest emitters for the UK are transport and energy, which account for about 25 to 30% each in terms of pre-COVID figures. However, unlike agriculture, these sectors have already seen significant reductions in emissions from the early 1990s, whereas in agriculture, there are emissions made a reduction and then have flatlined when compared to these other sectors. But we need to do more to achieve net zero and to demonstrate to consumers and other stakeholders that, you know, we are moving in the right direction, and for us also to look at the opportunities linked to achieving net zero collectively. Most of the emissions in agriculture come from three main greenhouse gases. Carbon dioxide, which is largely from the burning of fuels such as diesel. Nitrous oxide comes from the application of fertilisers and farmyard manure to land. And then we have methane from the fermentation process within the ruminants and from manures. We shouldn't forget that, you know, climate change will also have a significant impact on UK farming. We are seeing more extreme weather with greater incidence of flooding, drought, and this will impact the livelihoods of farmers and the ability to grow certain crops here in the UK. And I suppose it's worth pointing out that whilst we've got this sort of very variable weather that's being driven by climate change in the longer term, we are looking at how we can support farmers to sort of manage some of these impacts. So we have an excellent source of information on the AHDB website to help farmers become more resilient to flood and drought. on the AHDB Weather Hub.
Okay, and you can find the AHDB Weather Hub at ahdb.org.uk.
Tom Pearson is an arable farmer from Cambridgeshire. Tom has spent a lot of his time auditing the carbon emissions on his farm, looking at the importance of soils and the role they play. He's also got a great interest in regenerative agriculture. Hi, Tom. Thanks for sparing the time. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and your farm.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. So I took over the farm about 5 years ago, a little bit of a changeover with my dad over 2 years. And we farm a family. It's a family farm in West Cambridgeshire on chalky boulder clay. And I guess I took over. It was a very traditional farm. It was a very well looked after farm. But there were just sort of grumblings in the background I was reading and hearing about and thinking, I wonder if I should carry on the farm as a very conventional farmer. So just as I changed, I joined the year before, I persuaded my dad to buy a no-till drill, mainly off the back of, you know, controlling blackgrass and spring barley. And then from there, that gave me the opportunity to experiment a bit with no-till. And so I didn't really have carbon footprint in my mind at that point. I guess I'd heard a little bit about it, but you know, to begin with, I suppose, you know, I was in a fast learning curve. I'd been on the farm a lot as a teenager, but been elsewhere in between, and so I was learning what happened in a conventional system, then trying to sort of manage what might happen in a slightly different system. And then I guess it was actually a friend of mine who lives in the city. He had his kid come home from school and say, you know, what are you going to do to help stop climate change, Dad? And, you know, this poor guy in the city's fumbling around talking about LED lights and, you know, electricity from a green supplier. And it just got me thinking, you know, we're in an amazing position to contribute to that. And, you know, the last thing I want is my kids turning around to me saying, what are you doing? And you know, knowing perfectly well, there's lots more I can do than most of other people. So that's sort of part of that bit that kicked it off to begin with. And then, you know, I look back on it now and I just sort of think, you know, blimey, I 6 years ago, I had no idea carbon dioxide was released from heavy cultivations. I had no idea nitrous oxide was a greenhouse gas. I mean, it's incredible what we're all suddenly dealing with, I guess, this sort of almost information overload. But I've worked hard to try and sort of push through that initial hurdle of just sort of seeing all this and thinking, what on earth am I going to do about it? And actually sort of picking out ways of practicing on the farm, ways of doing things. And obviously a big part of that was, I was talking to someone and they sort of said, oh, that's great. Yeah, are you using a toolkit? I was like, what? Sure, I must have heard about it, but, you know, passed me by and suddenly thought, blimey, yeah, I really should be measuring this stuff. And, you know, we started measuring a bit of soil organic matter, I suppose, you know, back in 2017. And then I finally got around to doing using the Farm Carbon Toolkit in 2019 harvest. And it was a bit of an eye-opener, I guess.
So so you've been doing your bit to try and reduce your carbon footprint. Just tell us a little bit more about that then, like, sort of broadening it out from what you've already been saying.
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose in I had this idea I wanted to move down the regenerative agriculture pathway. As I said, to begin with, not necessarily the carbon footprint pushing me in that direction. But the more I learned about it, the more I realized, you know, that's a significant part of the picture now. And then when I did the toolkit, you know, I think there was, you know, there was some incredibly surprising results from that. I could not believe that, but we are solely an arable farm, but I couldn't believe how much fertilizer had an impact in our carbon footprint. It just blew my mind away. You know, and I mean, I suppose we always think of we're always a bit cautious about, you know, plant protection products. We, you know, careful about how much we're using. I think fertilizer, we just feel a bit, you know, I always thought it was my friend, to be honest. You know, fertilizer helps me grow great yields, and then I suddenly realized, well, actually, hang on a second, it's not maybe as good as all that for the greenhouse gases. And actually, ironically, you know, you start looking at regenerative agriculture and realizing, well, you know, artificial fertilizers particularly are probably not very good for the soil either. Sure, you have to use them to a certain extent to be able to get yield, but I think we suddenly sort of felt, gosh, I've really got to think a bit harder about how we're using our fertilizer.
So do you think generally farmers understand the impact of fertilizers and organic materials on the carbon footprint?
the short answer, and I'm sure there are lots that do, but I'm sure there are lots and lots that don't. And you know, I don't think that's something to, I mean, I don't think it's something to beat yourself up about. If you suddenly realize you didn't realize all this, that's fine. You know, the first step is to understand you know, they're actually, hey, hang on a second, this is quite a big deal. And then not to be, you know, sort of put off and say, well, oh, that's just what I've got to use. And, you know, that's just the way it is. You know, I think I've learned over the last two or three years since I really appreciated the fertilizer that, you know, there are ways of actually, you know, rationalizing your nitrogen. You know, we all feel we rationalize everything to try and, you know, get the best out of our farms. But actually, I think fertilizer just needs a little bit of extra attention and care taken to understand, you know, on top of the fact you want to reduce it because it costs money, actually there's a whole carbon footprint on top of that it's really worth paying attention to.
So you started off carrying out a carbon audit, is that right?
Yeah, so put in touch with Becky Wilson, actually, you know, with the Farm Carbon Toolkit. And you know, it can feel a little bit baffling doing it. It's just one of those things. It's a bit like I don't know, it's a bit like mapping out your farm or something. In the first bit, it takes forever, doesn't it? But once you've done it, a lot of those things don't change the next year. So, but you know, generally speaking, a lot of the data you've got, you have it anyway. You just got to sort of dig it out. And particularly, I mean, I benchmark my farm, you know, the financial benchmark with HGB. There's actually quite a lot of crossover between those two from a figures point of view as well. So as long as the record keeping is reasonably good, which it, you know, we really should be keeping good records, then it's not too much of an onerous task. And I think the outcome of it is really interesting. They're really good, well displayed, good results, easy to read, and we can make some changes from that.
Well, that's a good plug for one of the AHDB tools. So thank you for that. But were you surprised by any of the findings that came out of the audit?
Yeah, well, as I said, I mean, yeah, obviously the fertilizer was just a, you know, complete shocker. I couldn't believe that was, I mean, you know, you're talking 75% of your carbon footprint. And that was on 2019. That was an amazing year for yields for us. We were pushing the nitrogens. You know, we weren't really, sure, I had sort of sections of the farm in regenerative agriculture. Ultimately, we were in the most part still running mostly conventional. And so I'm trying to remember now. I think we had a carbon footprint of about 0.5. Well, there's lots of different ways of measuring, you know, coming up with the end result. But if you look at the amount of equivalent carbon per kilogram of produce, I think we were on about 0.37 or something. So it was nothing special. It wasn't awful, but it wasn't great. So that you know, that was interesting. I was a bit disappointed by the sequestration. I mean, I sort of thought that our farm had lots of margins and lots of bits of woodland here and there. And sure, you know, it helps. But it's interesting when you can start looking at some what-if scenarios and start looking at, well, hang on a second, you know, a lot of these elms things are coming out, woodland schemes and all that. And hang on a second, you know what, if I got a decent price for planting a wood on this terrible field with 38% headlands on it and a horrible streak of acidic soil down the middle, maybe I'd do better to do that. And, you know, it's just nice sort of playing around with some of these possibilities. That is quite drastic. Obviously there's a lot less drastic things you can do, and we did. So
tell us some ideas, some of the things that were less drastic then. What did you do?
Well, we obviously didn't want to shy away from the fertilizer issue. Okay, so you know, I think you have an opportunity, you know, we have NMAX calculations, we're in NVZ zone here, and you can just do those calculations, just basically max out on the nitrogen and aim to sort of go for that. And you just have to be a little bit more flexible with the growing season and more sensible about realistically how much nitrogen does this crop actually need. And just be a bit more sort of flexible with your decision-making through the year as your crop grows and as about how much nitrogen you're actually applying. And I think that's important. I was interested, immediately interested by the, just the manufacturers of nitrogen and how certain companies are starting to publish their carbon footprints on nitrogen, and also, you know, claim that they've got you know, better facilities for making nitrogen with a less carbon footprint. So I started being interested in making sure I'm buying the right brands. I guess we invested in a spreader with section control, so that's a nice easy win, really simple, The next step, obviously, is variable rates, and haven't quite got down that route yet. We have got through the sort of soil sampling to allow us to sort of start doing that, but it's a little bit of a bigger jump for us at the moment. So we're just sort of working out where we start that one. Other things are completely, you know, rainwater harvesting. I mean, we suddenly realised we've got capacity probably to get 1 million litres of water off our roofs, and there I am sort of sucking 3,000 litres out into our tank straight off the mains. And you sort of look back and you think, why on earth am I doing this? And of course, plus you're adding we've got incredibly high water around here, so you're adding to sort that out as well. And it all just seems bonkers. So you know, we looked at rainwater harvesting. We're just about to sort of include that in the next few months when it dries up a bit. Sort all that out on some big roof space we've got. So that was another thing we did. You know, I think we really started looking at trying to bring back legumes. I mean, you know, when I was on the farm as a teenager, I remember my dad just saying, "That's the last time I'm ever going to grow beans," and he never did it since. And of course, you know, he had the glory years of Olsey rape as well. But that sort of forced our hands. Like, we do still grow rape, but not nearly as much as we used to. And I think bringing back some legumes, obviously legumes, they don't require any nitrogen and they fix nitrogen. So that's bound to reduce your fertilizer input. And indeed other crops, you know, we do more spring cropping, partly because we can get, you know, longer period of time with cover crops in the ground. But obviously, you know, spring cropping requires less artificial fertilizer as well. And for us, we're quite lucky. We usually get malting premium on our barley, and the numbers do stack up reasonably well compared to a second or third wheat maybe. So that's definitely something we've changed a lot. We stopped cutting our hedges every year. I mean, that's another thing, you know, I couldn't believe that we just cut our hedges every year. Complete waste of time. So you know, there's plenty of good reasons to not do that, but you know, it's just wasting fuel. It's although hedges aren't, I think I'm right in saying hedges aren't actually included in the calculator at the moment. I would really hope they will be, but you know, they're still obviously sequestering carbon, you know, if you leave them to grow longer for 2 or 3 years. And I think the other thing we've done a lot of is mapping out our non-productive areas of fields. That takes a bit of time. It's not, you know, sometimes it's obvious, you know, everyone knows there's a bit of a field somewhere that really we shouldn't be bothering with. But, you know, we start overlaying yield map. We started yield mapping a few years ago, starting to look at that. You know, we haven't actually used satellite data, to be honest, but we know it's out there. We could start looking at MVDI data and really getting a feel for which bits of the land are working, which bits aren't. And because obviously productivity is a major part of it, isn't it? And, you know, you can, if you have non-productive areas, that basically just messes up your carbon footprint per kilogram of wheat produced.
So, I mean, you know, no farmer wants something else to do. You know, every farmer's got plenty to do. And I guess listeners to this will be thinking, so is this easy or difficult? Or, you know, where do you stand as far as that's concerned? I mean, encouraging fellow farmers to sort of go down the route that you've gone down. Is this a rewarding and relatively straightforward, or does it keep you awake at night?
Plenty of other things to keep me awake at night, so I don't add this one to it. But it's an audit. It's got numbers in. There's a bit of effort involved in it. Then there's nothing in there that's impossible to get hold of or will take you ages and ages to find. I for some people, that's, you know, numbers and filling in stuff is more onerous task than others. I think it's one of these things. You know, you do it and it's suddenly not quite as difficult as you thought, and then if someone else close by needs a bit of a hand, it's actually really easy to tell them what to do or tell them how it goes. You know, I think it's just getting over the hurdle of starting it, you know. Yeah. Setting aside a little bit of time, maybe knowing that you need a certain few bits of information, which, you know, I'm sure the website will tell you roughly what you need in advance. You know, ultimately you need to know the amount, you know, the amount you produce for that harvest. You need your fertilizer records. You need some basic stuff about your cropping areas and things like that. I mean, you know, sure, there's more stuff involved, but you can save it and go back to it. But the basics you can get in once you've done it with it. And then, you know, then the possibilities are endless. And obviously there's some stuff you could do that takes a lot of effort, you know, but there are these quick wins. You can do stuff quickly and feel good about it. And you know, most of the stuff you'll do will probably save you money anyway, you know.
So have you got any examples of quick wins that encouraged you?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, you know, the rainwater harvesting was an absolute no-brainer. You know, but I think there were actually grants knocking around for some people for that as well. You know, that just seemed bonkers. We'd never thought of doing that before, so I'm pleased we got that sorted. And obviously, you know, don't cut your hedges every year. They were my two sort of biggest quick wins that no one grumbled about. You know, double checking your fertilizer usage. I think we were definitely always legally within the NMAX, but you know, you did wonder in the back in the day when you were, you know, you're getting proteins of 15% in your milling wheat. You're thinking, well, what the hell's the point of that? You know, can't get paid any more for it. It seemed like a bit of a waste. And then there's a lot more stuff you can go. And it all gets, to me, it's quite exciting. I mean, you know, if you're combining this carbon footprinting with a regenerative agriculture approach to farming, then, you know, the whole world opens up to all sorts of incredible opportunities and things you can experiment with and stuff, and it certainly makes farming a pretty exciting thing to be involved in. Yeah, I mean, I think in the future we've got to remember that lots of other industries are starting to have to publish their carbon footprint for their product. You know, we should be publishing our carbon footprint for our product. I'm sure we're going to be made to do it soon, so we might as well get on and understand it now. Definitely.
Tom, thank you very much for sparing the time. So that was Tom Pearson telling us all to get on with it and stick with it.
Thank you very much.
I'm now joined by Phil White, and Phil has a mixed farm in Oxfordshire. Thanks for sparing the time, Phil. Just tell us a little bit about your farm.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for having me on, John. It's great to be here. We are a family farm, South Oxfordshire. We farm about 250 hectares with about 100 hectares of arable. And then we've got native herd of suckler cows, Shorthorn Angus suckler cows. We've got a few sheep. We do a bit of poultry, both at turkeys at Christmas, and we also do chickens all year round. So yeah, traditional mixed farm, really.
All right. Okay. So tell us a little bit about your journey in reducing your carbon footprint.
Oh yeah. Well, I suppose we've always been very conscious of our responsibilities as stewards of the environment, as well as farmers and producers of food. Dad was very, very keen on his conservation, and so I sort of brought up with that. But I suppose in the last few years, we've become increasingly exposed to the evidence about the deteriorating climate emergency on telly with David Attenborough and so on, but also just closer to home, you know, we've got about a mile and a half of the River Tame, and the frequency and severity of the flooding, there is no doubt, has got worse. And also the droughts, you know, the last couple of two or three years, we've had, you know, really severe droughts on our light land. So, you know, it's becoming very apparent to us at home that things are not improving, things are getting worse. And I think also that as livestock farmers, increasing noise about the impact of red meat and the perception about methane emissions and how damaging that might be for the environment. And perhaps we might come back to that later, because I think there's, you know, a bit of a public awareness needs to be done there. So I suppose two or three years ago, I started to look into this a bit more and do a bit of research. And yeah, that's where we are, really.
So have you done your carbon audit?
Oh, well, yes. Good, great question. I mean, it has been a very steep learning curve. And, you know, one of the easiest things to do is to go out and Google it, find the different options open to you and log in and start the audit process. And perhaps for busy farmers like us, and I guess like most farmers, getting it done is not quite so easy. So, no, it's the straight answer is it's in process. But as we've been going through that process and doing research and watching webinars and going to podcasts and doing some reading, I think we're learning and adjusting as we go along. And we've, as well as having started the audit process and started doing some soil organic matter testing, we've also just thought, well, look, we've started to implement some management changes as we go.
So have you got some sort of early changes in mind?
Well, yeah, we're working with a local arable farmer who I met at a social event, and we got chatting, and I'd heard he was very much into his no-till, zero-till cultivations. We were, at the time, very conventional plough, power, harrow, combination drill system, which was working perfectly fine, to be honest. But here I got chatting, and that's evolved into a sort of a decision 2 years ago that we would implement a no-till policy on our arable crops with lots of cover crops. On the livestock side, I suppose the biggest management change that we've implemented is starting in 2018 was to go rotational grazing. And I know that the evidence for this is still not complete, but I personally am convinced that by changing the way we're managing our grazing now, we are seeing not only significant improvements in pasture quality and quantity, but also we're seeing marked improvement in soil organic matter. And it's that whole bit, isn't it, about integrating livestock into the arable rotation, where you can see some of the biggest gains. And going back to our relationship with our neighbour, you know, he's now starting to sort of talk about maybe having, he planted some grass clover lays for us to make some silage this year, and talking about having some livestock to do some grazing on his arable fields. So I think, you know, it's a mutual benefit for both of us, really.
Phil, have you got any specific examples around livestock?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the jury's out on the rotational grazing thing, but I'm sure that's making a difference. But I would say another immediate way that we have made some management changes, which I'm sure are making a difference in terms of our carbon footprint, are a move from a more intensive system where we've housed all our livestock in the winter. And just to use our example, we've got a tub mixer where we do a total mix ration, which is burning diesel. There's another tractor on the straw bedder that's burning diesel. So we're moving away from that to much more, and we're lucky with our soil, we can do this, but growing cover crops, outwintering, bale grazing. And for this year, for the first time, we've got our 50 odd young stock out on a crop of fodder beet. So just give you an example, from last year, that would have taken me 20 minutes, half an hour, with two tractors running in the shed, bedding them up, feeding them. This year, it's less than 10 minutes to move an electric fence 5 metres down the field. And, you know, all of the obvious benefits in terms of not burning diesel, but I think also building soil organic matter and the health and how well those cattle are looking, not to mention the saving I'm making in the inputs. So those are the sorts of things that I think it's worth exploring and seeing how that might fit in your system.
Perfect example, thank you. And from what you've seen and experienced with other livestock farmers that are listening to this, would you encourage them to look carefully and closely at what you've done and see whether they should adopt these principles?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we've got to think about this in two ways, haven't we, in terms of the sort of motivation. I mean, clearly, ideologically, you know, it's the right thing to do, is to, as part of what a whole of wider society is doing, to address the number one challenge for our generation, which is the climate emergency. You know, we've got kids are growing up, you know, and I heard an item on the news yesterday that says in their lifetime, you know, this could become catastrophic if we don't do something about it. But also it needs to be done in an economic way. And if someone hasn't already said it before, you know, it's very hard to be green when you're in the red. It's got to make sense. For me, the two reasons I would encourage people to look at it is, firstly, that from what limited amount I've learned about, you know, the benefits of improving soil health, it's going to help you to deliver a profit. And I can already see the benefits on, you know, in the last couple of years, where we can get onto the ground where we wouldn't have been able to get onto it before, because it's draining away better in the winter and holding more water in the drought in the summer. But also for selling our product, you know, consumer attitudes towards what we produce are changing, like it or not. And, you know, we need to be able to make a clear business case that what we're doing is environmentally, I would say, not only sustainable, but also regenerative. You know, we're actually making things better. And for me, that's the biggest opportunity that there is here. You know, what other industry can say we're making a positive impact in terms of locking up carbon? People can be carbon neutral in various other industries, but farming is the only one, by building soil carbon, that we can actually make a positive impact. And I think that's a great story to tell.
And I agree. And I think as well, then, from what you're saying, it sounds like there's a real sort of mindset journey as well as the sort of the business journey.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think, you know, it's worth saying that if other farmers thinking of making these changes or anything like me, they might look to their friends and neighbours and not necessarily meet with a very positive response from everyone, because there is a natural reluctance to change what has worked for the last 40 or 50 years. But what I've done, and I've been really lucky, is that I've become part of a couple of discussion groups. There's the AHDB Progressive Beef Group, which I belong to, and another group with Precision Grazing, looking specifically at the rotational grazing. And people in those groups are like-minded, open-minded, much more progressive than me, prepared to look at new ideas, but also, I think really important, it's the positive attitude and the willingness to offer unending advice and support, which has just been so great. Because when you're a bit uncertain with something new and you just want to ask the dumb question that you're almost afraid to ask, or find out if someone else has had a go at something, it's great to give you the confidence to make the change.
In terms of, as a farmer, your produce, you're also selling directly to customers, aren't you? So there's not a middleman. You're building a farm shop.
Yeah, we have done a bit of that. I mean, I suppose the way we got into it was a bit of an evolution for us, because we always have done turkeys at Christmas, and we've enjoyed that. You know, people coming back year after year and saying how much they enjoy what we produce. So a couple of years ago, we started doing a beef box, lamb box, and that's evolved into a sort of weekly pop-up shop. And now we have an arrangement with a local veg box delivery company that have just started up a meat box scheme. So I think from my interaction with our customers, there are varying levels of knowledge about this. And some people, when you start talking about carbon footprint, their eyes glaze over and they don't really want to know anymore. They just want to know that they've got a nice product and they know where it's come from. But there is no doubt a lot more interest in this area. And I think that's only going to increase. I mean, going back to the methane point I mentioned earlier on, I think it's really important that we start to address that, because red meat, especially grazing livestock, is getting a really hard time about the methane emissions. But, you know, having looked into it a little bit, and a very good source of information I would recommend for people is to Google Rethinking Methane. It's on YouTube. It's a short video, and it just explains how methane gas is cycled back into the system. So if you keep your livestock numbers the same, it breaks down over 10 years and the methane is not, it's not an issue. What is an issue is fossil fuels. That's where the problem that we need to address it comes from. And actually having livestock grazing in a system that's building carbon in the soil is actually a positive impact. And that's, I think, the story we need to be telling our customers.
And that's a great point to end on. So brilliant. Thank you very much indeed, Phil. Thank you for sparing the time.
Thanks very much.
Let's now hear from senior scientist in the AHDB environment team about his views on steps that levy payers can take. Welcome, Harley Stoddart.
Okay, I've been with AHDB for nearly 10 years now, and I lead on the agricultural footprinting for the organisation, and I guess for the industry as well. So that's both greenhouse gases and carbon, but also diffused pollution as well. So I spend a lot of my time working out the calculations for carbon footprints for the whole industry, for individual sectors, right down to farms and individual crops.
But what specifically can each of the sectors do?
Yeah, okay. So actually, luckily, a lot of what can be done here and now is not only good for the environment, but it's also good for the farming business as well. Essentially, you know, resource use efficiency is the common driver to both economic and environmental sustainability. But I think it's important to make a differentiation here. We're talking about greenhouse gases and carbon footprints rather than other impacts such like diffuse pollution. So if I start with the cropping sectors, you know, cereals, oilseeds, potatoes and horticulture, a large part of it comes down to the fertilisers that are used, both the synthetic bagged fertilisers and the organic mucks and manures as well. So the objective here is to use what the crop needs, but only as much as the crop needs. In addition, use a FACTS-qualified advisor, have a crop nutrient management plan, and follow the plan. Maximum yield and quality without spending any more than you need to get the result that you want. For beef and sheep, it's a slightly different approach, but it's still all about efficient production. Get your animals to the best finishing weight as quickly as you are able to. The economic optimum for slaughter is roughly the same point as the environmental optimum as well. When the live weight is plateauing, it's time to go. This reduces the amount of feed used and residence time on farm, which thereby reduces the carbon footprint. But it also increases the feed efficiency and the profitability. But you need to measure to manage to minimise your impact. Know how much you're feeding and know how much and how fast your animals are growing. Dairy is a bit different again, although it's about efficient production, and then particularly with dairy, it's efficient feeding. Feed, as we know, is the single biggest variable on-farm cost. So work with your feed advisor to optimise the feed in to milk out. Measure to manage again, and don't use more than you need. Look after what you've got and manage your clamps well. Lost feed, whether that's in the field, in transport or in storage, is both a waste of money and releases more CO2. Also, for sheep, for beef, for dairy, optimise your grass production. Get more from what you've got. Grass is a crop. Treat it as such. Have a good crop nutrient management plan and follow it. Pig production in the UK is pretty well integrated, which means that they have a really good handle on feed efficiency already and know their feed conversion rates. So the key here is continual monitoring to review, to revise both the feeding regimes, stocking densities, etc. And as with all livestock systems, the healthier the animals, the more efficient they are, and the lower the GHGs emitted will be.
Okay, so the message that I'm getting from that then is manage the business as well as you possibly can, and that helps the environment. So it's a win-win, is that right?
Absolutely. The one thing that is within each and every farm business's control is understanding their cost of production. Know your business, hone your business, be as fit for purpose as possible, and the environmental benefits will come along with the economic ones.
Okay, Harley, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
If you have any comments about this podcast or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch via the feedback area on the AHDB website, ahdb.org.uk. Throughout Carbon Week, between the 1st and the 5th of March, daily webinars are taking place and other events. You can find out the details by visiting the AHDB website. Thanks to my guests, Tom Pearson, Phil White, John Foote and Harley Stoddart. And thanks to podcast producer Sarah Meesom. Stay safe, stay well. I'm John Bates. Thanks for listening.